the 20th century is how I summarize the greatest century of persecution. And we stopped last week just before the great wars of decolonization, the final stage, which was Portugal. And the Portuguese fought for 14 years a very hard war against various resistance groups in Mozambique and Angola and Cape Verde Islands, and they battled hard and long. But in 1973, you'll remember what happened, there was the Yom Kippur War. And during the Yom Kippur War, Israel was about to get overwhelmed. And although Kissinger didn't want to do anything to help them, although the Soviets were helping Syria and Egypt enormously, there was a phone call from Golda Meir to President Richard Nixon. And she pleaded for help, that without the help they could not stand, they would be overwhelmed and cease to exist. And Richard Nixon had always been brought up by his mother to care for the people of Israel, and that the time may come when he'd have to make a choice, and he made that choice. And against the Secretary of State's strong opposition, he started around-the-clock delivery of vast quantities of American weaponry to Israel, to resupply Israel, who had lost, they were losing everything. They didn't have enough weapons and ammunition to resupply those things that had been knocked out. And this is just in the midst of the whole Watergate scandal too. So he's going down anyway. But nevertheless, he did, to his own credit, he did come out and he gave massive support to Israel. And Israel was losing hundreds of tanks, hundreds of aircraft. It was a massive battle. Of course, they were causing much bigger casualties on the other side. They couldn't afford to lose them. They couldn't resupply everything. And Europe, to their disgrace and shame, refused to give any American airlines any landing rights, except for Britain. That was a bit too far north. But Portugal allowed the American Air Force to do, use the Azores in Portugal for their stopping, which they needed. They couldn't reach Israel in one go. They had to refuel. And so the Azores Islands, which at that stage was Portuguese next to it, and Portugal, were the essential stop-off points for all these Hercules aircrafts and C-130s. And so the next thing was that along came these planes flying in, and Bill Baffin said when he heard all this and he saw the map and he saw next to Azores port, he said, look for a revolution in Portugal in the next year. And he said, I was wrong. It happened in 6 months. In fact, 6 months later, Portugal went through a communist revolution, and with a socialist government, they handed over all their African dominions, which had been part of metropolitan Portugal for 500 years, in cases like Angola. They handed over not to the people, not to the different parties, but just to the communist parties in each one of those places. It was a totally communist handover. And the handover of Angola, for example, to communist MPLA terrorists, who immediately invited in Soviet and Cuban troops to help them crush the Christian churches in these countries. This was a turning point. That was Agostinho Neto in Angola. In Mozambique, it was Frelimo's leader was Samora Machel. But in each case, communist. Now, there were other parties. Like in Angola, there was the FNLA, who were more pro-Western. There was UNITA, that was much more pro-Western. But they were ignored, just to the hardcore communists. They didn't give a referendum, there was no elections, it was just hand over to the most radical Marxist bunch of mass murdering thugs. And the MPLA Marxists, these people had started their campaign in Angola in 1960 by literally running people through, 42 women and children and men through chainsaws and buzzsaws at a sawmill. I mean, that's the kind of people they were. They got World Council Church of Support, they were vicious people, and in Mozambique you had Samora Machel, as depicted here, this cannibal who ate human flesh, who literally murdered his first wife's first child because he didn't believe that he was the father, and he declared war against the church. He destroyed so many churches, so many massacres, and of course we've documented this in the killing fields of Mozambique. Mozambique and Angola went from being Catholic countries, which restricted Protestant missions and severely limited Bibles. There's people that we know, like Johan van der Kolff, who smuggled Bibles into Mozambique in the 1960s and 70s when it was a Portuguese Catholic dominion. And that's quite funny to think that you used to have to smuggle Bibles into Mozambique when it was under Portuguese, and then you had to smuggle Bibles into it was under the communists. So it went from Catholicism to communism, both of which were hostile to Protestant evangelical Christianity. And the Cuban troops marched in the center of Luanda. And this was absolutely critical, because up till this point, the control of southern Africa was very stably pro-Western, pro-Christian civilization. Between Portugal, Southwest Africa, Rhodesia, and South Africa, you had a very solid, strong bloc of civilized nations. And the attitude then was, there's no way that these countries ever hand over to Marxist thugs. Yes, Congo was in chaos, and yes, there was all sorts of revolutions in Nigeria, and yes, there was a civil war in Nigeria. These countries were in a mess, but it would never happen in Angola. Angola and Mozambique were not colonies. Angola and Mozambique were metropolitan Portugal. They were part of Portugal itself. They didn't regard them as colonies, but just overseas parts of metropolitan Portugal. But with these being handed over, the arms race, the Soviet Cold War became very hot, and Angola became the hot spot in the Cold War. It was the sharp end of the Cold War. And as you can see, Fidel Castro visited, and he put 55,000 Cuban troops into Angola. It was phenomenal. At that moment, by the way, the Americans at that stage under Ford and Kissinger asked South Africa to intervene to stop the Cubans seizing control of all of Angola. And so South Africa sent in 3,000 troops, Colonel Breitenbach running, I think, one column, and another colonel was running the coastal column, and between the two of them, they carved up the country, and they were within sight of Luanda within weeks. They literally rolled up the whole communist mess, and just these 3,000 South African troops. And he said, they didn't have armored cars. They were working flatbed trucks and Land Rovers with Vickers, First World War type machine guns. The South African army was not well prepared for the type of war they were going to face. They're facing much more advanced weaponry from the communist side. And Angolan War shook the South African army up to a massive, massive rearmament program. And Arms Corps woke up to the need to produce a whole better range of weapons. But those 3,000 under-equipped, overwhelmed men managed to win Angola. But when they got to Luanda and they saw the ships in Luanda literally loading their tanks on and they were fleeing, at that point America voted against South Africa's involvement in Angola at the Security Council, and at that point the Southern government said, what a bunch of backstabbing hypocrites, and what are we there for anyway? We're there on America's invitation. So they turned around and went out, which was also short-sighted. You could see the Marxist-Leninist ideology of these people in Angola. Everywhere you've got these sort of trinity, Marx, Engels, and Lenin. And as I said, these three men have one thing in common, they're all dead. And they knew that Angola was seen to be the fountainhead for establishing the triumph of the revolution throughout Africa. And this is what they were claiming. And truly, Africa went aflame from that point. Basically, you could say, in the 4 years of Jimmy Carter, 1976 through to 1980, in those 4 years, 13 countries fell to communism, including Rhodesia. And Africa turned into, Southern Africa turned into one big battleground for the Marxists. It was a terrible thing when the Portuguese betrayed Mozambique and Angola into the hands of Marxist revolutionaries. And this is the end result. Massacres, landmine wars, ambushes. And after 1980 is another key date. After a courageous 15-year fight for survival, Rhodesia is betrayed into the hands of Robert Mugabe's communist army, and many missionaries and many Christians were martyred, and many churches were destroyed in Zimbabwe. And Rhodesia had fought a very courageous action holding back the communist tide. The Rhodesian war, I think, will be seen as something like the Spartan Thermopylae holding up the hordes of the East for a limited time, but they won time for the West by the very small undermanned army. Do you know the entire Rhodesian Air Force at maximum mobilization could put 40 helicopters in one place? And that meant there wasn't one reserve. 40 helicopters, total maximum mobilization. And on their biggest airborne operation, they could put 198 paratroopers in at one place to attack the terrorist base at Chimoio. That was its total airborne capability. There wasn't one plane in reserve. And my brother was involved in that operation in the attack on Chimoio, which is a 5,000-strong terrorist base in Mozambique, and the 198 Rhodesians destroyed it. Nevertheless, despite the Rhodesians winning all their battles, this Marxist Thug Mugabe was forced upon Rhodesia by the British Lord Soames and Lord Carrington and the Lancaster House Agreement, and he came to power through landmines and massacring of Catholic nuns and missionaries, Red Cross ambulance drivers, missionaries and their children, like at Elam, wiping out people travelling in buses, shooting tens of thousands of people murdered and mutilated by Robert Mugabe's thugs to get to power, and that's why he's continued to stay in power that way. Yeah. If people come to power by murdering innocent people, they stay in power the same way. And so bayoneting people in the back while their hands are tied is why. That's exactly what it is. So this is why Zimbabwe is actually a very good example of what decolonization has done. The West left Africa in the lurch at the moment it needed it the most. And while a lot of things may have been done wrong by different colonials, like the Belgians were pretty backward in preparing the people for independence, and the Belgian Congo, while it was well run and efficient and good roads and everything else like that, the fact still is that in 1960 they were not ready, and Belgium, just the moment there was the first strikes and riots, they gave independence. You can't do that. If you've got a rebellious teenager, you don't give them the keys to the car, a bottle of alcohol and a shotgun. I mean, that's just insane. In fact, that's exactly how one British diplomat described the decolonization process. He said it's like giving a 13-year-old a bottle of whiskey, the keys to the car and a shotgun. And they just destroyed and pillaged, and after all that Europe had done to build up Africa and to establish civilization, it's extraordinary that they would abandon them. Here's the picture I was talking about of the Cuban tanks and trucks being offloaded off the ships from Cuba. Soviet vessels, of course. But they were literally loading them all up and fleeing when the South African troops were in the outskirts of Luanda. They were fleeing. And it was the cowardly action of the US State Department at the United Nations Security Council that turned South Africa around when they said, well, if the people asked us to get involved for the sake of Western civilization, can't even stand up for us on the world stage, then let's go home. And the Cubans marched back in, and the people in Angola suffered. How many churches were destroyed? The arms race was on. The Cold War was very intense. The Cuban presence was very plain, and so was the Soviet presence. Here you can see Soviet warships and Soviet generals and marshals meeting their Angolan counterparts in Luanda Harbour. And these are pictures taken by South African Air Force around our coast. You can see here, this is a Chinese vessel. This one here is a Soviet vessel. Note the helicopter on the back. And this here is another Chinese vessel, as you can see. And all the specs and when and where. And so these are military intelligence pictures taken around our coast. This is one of the classic Russian fishing vessels. You know, as though there's not enough fish up in the North Seas around Russia, they've got to come around the coast of South Africa and Southwest Africa to do their fishing. And we all knew that they were fishing for information, not for the ones that swim in the water. And Russian battleships in the harbour in Luanda. These are all things we saw and documented. Here you can see the Russians training SWAPO terrorists in Angola, and notice the people on the wall. Okay, you've got Dos Santos, the dictator of Angola, you've got Lenin, you've got Marx, you've got Engels, and you've got these Russians and a Politburo, and this is the political training of SWAPO terrorists in Angola. You can notice also the flag here, that's actually a Vietnamese flag. What's a Vietnamese flag? It was a who's who of the communist world in Angola. This is, here you can see a very interesting historical picture. You see the South African tank and crew outside. And you've got, this is a classroom where they were training SWAPO terrorists. You can see the SWAPO posters, SWAPO rank structure, and you've got Brezhnev's picture, Fidel Castro's mugshot, and you see they left in a bit of a rush, but that's just a very interesting raid behind the lines picture, documenting game, but this was part of the Cold War. People today want to depict the whole thing, that what was going on was merely wars of national liberation. Rubbish. Wars of communist colonial expansion. This is Soviet imperialism, that's all. And this is the first captured examples of Soviet multiple grenade launchers, tripod-based anti-personnel. This would be devastating. This would break up any infantry assault. So it's not, they can spew out 400 meters distance grenades. It can, in the space of about a minute, it can empty the drum out, just shooting out grenades all over. And you've just got to swivel it a bit, and it'll pepper an advancing infantry force with the whole of the grenades. Now, the South Africans who captured this in 1980 in Angola, and this is the first one seen, and they were documented by Colonel Des Radmore in Jane's Defence Weekly, and on this basis, he said, well, we can do better than this. The South Africans then marketed the Arms Corps version, which is shown up all over the world now. The infantry held, shoulder-fired, multiple grenade launcher, which is a South African Arms Corps innovation. So we took the Russian idea and improved it, made it more mobile. And that's a real ambush breaker. Our chaps would go into Angola and they could pepper any ambush position with grenades at such a rate, faster than anybody could possibly throw. Here you see the Russian T-54 tanks in the streets in Luanda, Cuban run. So the South African army had to immediately respond. Now you can see the old infantry outfits, the old webbing that we used. They upgraded a lot since then, but that was like Second World War type webbing. It hadn't been improved on since the Second World War. At first, because the Vambaland was so flat, we had to have a lot of high position guard towers that you could see from a distance, and I remember climbing up this particular one a few times and also having a chance to shoot some of the 20mm machine gun on top. And this was the kind of very exposed position. You can imagine how exposed you feel up top there. You have to be very alert. And we would come under the rocket attacks and mortar attacks of the enemy. One reason why they had it so high, they believed that that high up, the mortar explosions wouldn't be able to send shrapnel that high up, and anyway, they put sandbags at the bottom as well. But you still felt pretty exposed. In the end, they put sacking around the ladder so you didn't feel too exposed while you were climbing up, but still, sacking's not quite a thing. And this was our kind of bases using the Biffles, the South African designed armored personnel carriers that would protect 10 fully equipped infantry, and the German Samuels that we used, and this is the South African manufactured G5 artillery piece, 155mm howitzers. They are the most advanced piece of field artillery in the world today. In fact, the Americans have had to buy them from South Africa because they don't have anything better. The 155mm howitzer, that could go from the center of Cape Town to Somerset West. That's, you know, about 56 kilometers easily, and it can also shoot tactical nukes from them. And we had those as well. Not that they were ever used, but they were available. And these were the artillery pieces that really laid waste to the Cuban mechanized infantry that that attacked at Cuito Carnaval in 1987. This was every morning patrol, the sappers, the engineers, clearing the mines, because this is what the terrorists would do. They'd come into the long, 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 long sand gravel roads in Southwest Africa, which were excellent roads, as you can see. But they would plant landmines. And of course, every morning, before anyone else got up and started traveling on farm vehicles or school buses, clearing the mines was, of course, the first job of the day. The infantry providing protection because they might ambush the engineers while they're clearing the mines, of course. So this is a standard operation. This is what you would see as a sunrise in Ondangwa. Alouette helicopters heading out. And this is troops returning from a raid in Angola. This was, in fact, this picture is taken in Angola, command tent and buffles around, and these are the Puma helicopters coming in to resupply the troops during Operation Smoke Show, 1980. The first views I got of Angola were of smashed, broken, wrecked houses. You could see the Portuguese had built some nice houses, but boy, did they get destroyed by the communists in just a few years. The 500 years of communist civilization was destroyed in 5 years. This is South Africa's frontline fighter, the Mirage, and the Mirage cheetahs were the best and the most innovative of them all, and they took on enemy MiGs. Here you can see the camera of a South African Mirage taking out a Cuban MiG inside Angola. That's the fuel igniting and scratch one MiG. Many a time there were dogfights in Angola, and these are just some of the pictures that I've accumulated of shot down enemy aircraft in Angola. In fact, I've just been contacted by a major military publication based in Vienna, Austria, wanting copies of our pictures of these downed Soviet MiGs. They're doing a big coffee table book on MiGs, and they said we had some of the best pictures they'd seen anywhere of these destroyed MiGs. This is the best. This is a Stinger missile hit from UNITA, and it took down this massive Hind helicopter. You can just see MI-24 totaled, not much left. That's the effect of a Stinger. And a Russian T-34 tank. More Russian T-34s have been built than any other tank in the history of the world, and more T-34s have been destroyed than any other tank in the history of the world. This is a classic example of an effective air attack on an infantry mechanized column. So you've got here a whole Cuban mechanized column that was shot up by South African Impalas. The first thing you've got to do when you come under air attack is bomb shell. They're all meant to deploy to the side off the road so that you don't present a single linear target for a strafing aircraft. Not one vehicle has been able to move out so fast as a South African attack. They took out that entire column without one vehicle being able to move out and deploy. That shows how effective our Air Force was in those kind of battles. Jonas Savimbi was South Africa's best ally in Angola. He was trained in communist China, and he said, "I learned from the Chinese how to fight. I also learned how not to win, how not to run a country." So the Chinese obviously don't know how to run a country, but I did learn guerrilla tactics from him. But his father was a Christian, an evangelist, an evangelical who was working on the railways, and the Portuguese kept moving him to another town because he'd be evangelized in one place. But all it did was enable him to plant churches in many towns along the whole Benguela railway line. And Jonas Savimbi told us that it was his sad duty to blow up the Benguela railway line where his father used to work, but he said he had to do this because this was how the communists were supplying their armies, which were oppressing his people, and he found it a sad duty to have to destroy this line in order to fight against the resupply of the enemy. You can see at the beginning, UNITA troops had a lot of South African obsolete webbing and equipment. You can see a wide range of weapons, including the G3s used by the Portuguese, the FNs used by the South Africans, the AKs that they captured from the communists, SKSs. I mean, there's a whole range of weapons that they captured. UNITA troops on patrol. Angola was really a very key part of the Cold War. In it, the Russians, the Cubans, the Vietnamese, the North Korean state poured in vast amounts of equipment. We had South African Air Force going up against East German planes, against Vietnamese troops, against North Koreans, against Russian pilots and Russian ground troops. We captured high-ranking Russians and Cubans. There was an enormous amount of Communist International in Angola. So Angola was very strategic for them. It's an oil-rich country. It's had an excellent infrastructure. Doesn't have any more. Portuguese left it an excellent infrastructure, but directed. It's also very, very rich in minerals. Not only oil, but diamonds and every other kind of mineral. It's in fact, very mineral-rich. I'm told by some people that Angola and the Congo together might be more mineral-rich than South Africa. I was told in Parliament recently that, in fact, it's not that South Africa is the most mineral-rich country in Africa, just as the best developed. Other parts of Africa have all the potential if they would run their economies well. Well, in the 1980s, there was a very positive movement, though. In America in particular, the Christian Reconstruction Movement was launched by Dr. R.J. Rushdoony in particular, and the Moral Majority Movement, trying to get the silent majority to speak up and to get involved in politics. Jerry Falwell succeeded in getting Ronald Reagan elected, changing America's direction from the Jimmy Carter appeasement into the Ronald Reagan, we're going to fight the evil empire and bring down the Berlin Wall. The pro-life movement really got up and running a bit late. They weren't on the field in 1973 when abortion was legalized throughout America, but they woke up a bit later. I'm told that South Africa is the only country in the world which had a pro-life movement effective and involved before abortion was legalized in the country. Apparently in every other country, the pro-life movement only gets started after they've legalized abortion. This is the only country in the world, I'm told, where the government can't say, we didn't know. We didn't know when life begins. We didn't know what abortion involved. But our government certainly heard how many times over from top medical experts, doctors for life, life begins at conception, abortion is murder. Well, we've been involved in also the resurgence of Christian schools and homeschooling, and praise God that what has been going on in America with a resurgence in these has been done in South Africa too, and at the heart of it is the Kwasibantu Mission, Africa Christian Action, Christians for Truth, the Voters Guide. This is all part of the Christian Reconstruction, Moral Majority, Pro-Life Movement, resurgence of Christian schools and homeschool curriculums worldwide. And it's good for us to be able to learn from overseas how they have done it, and to learn what we don't want to do. And just in our limited experience, we've seen how the media attacks one. In fact, this is so useful. A person who might get involved in just one issue, maybe Right to Life, maybe speaking out against the homosexual agenda in the schools, trying to brainwash the children into this kind of nonsense. And the moment you do it, what do you find? The media twists things. And the amount of people say, how can they say that? That's not true. And then they start to realize that maybe some people are running the media who don't exactly have free and fair, without fear and favor, just reporting the facts. And they start to realize there seems to be an agenda here. And so by God's grace, our experience of organizing demonstrations and outreaches and prayer vigils and going to Parliament has given us better insights into what the Christian Reconstruction movement worldwide has also been facing in their individual battlefields. Abortion is murder. The Bible commands us not to commit murder. The Lord hates hands that shed innocent blood. But we've been able to make that testimony on national TV and radio. We've been able to get outside Parliament. We've been able to go to the Nicomelan and make our stand against all of these things. And by God's grace, to SABC, and they've enabled us sometimes to actually go on national programs at prime time and to make a stand. So in the sense of being salt and light and being a remnant and having a prophetic voice, we are helping to lay some foundations for the future. Now, a lot of people look at this and say, we're just like that little Dutch boy trying to keep his fingers in the dike. The dike of Christian standards is developing cracks all over, and this huge sea of humanism out there is about to flood us, and we've got to have our fingers in here and our toes in there and ask sister to run out and get some help, because we've got our fingers in the dike and the whole dike's going to go. But in fact, that's not the correct picture at all. The correct picture is that sea and time is on our side, and it's the humanists who are having to plug up the holes and stop the light coming into their darkness and to prevent the biblical truth coming into their deception, because they can spend decades building chains that enslave people, but God can break those chains in a second. He can enslave people over a lifetime, but the Lord can set the captive free in a moment. So in fact, the real one who's got to be afraid is the humanist, and that's why he's terrified of films like The Passion of the Christ and Fireproof and Christian films that are coming out, and they've got to try and stop the expel that questions their intolerance when it comes to evolutionism and so on. And that's why they're so intolerant when it comes to a Christian school, one homeschooling curriculum, anything. Or our little pink agenda book. Goodness me, a little mission prints 5,000 copies of the pink agenda, and this is front page and 8 o'clock prime time news, and they've got to restrict it and ban it, and they've really absolutely going off the wall, frothing at the mouth, saying it's the worst homophobic hate speech ever printed. Before one copy had even come off the press, and no one had read one copy yet, and some other knew by clairvoyance, and they were calling for it to be banned, these very people who said that censorship is evil. But they were willing to make exceptions in our case. 1989 was a great anniversary. 20 years ago, the Berlin Wall fell. In fact, we're just reflecting yesterday, as Winner and I celebrate our 20th wedding anniversary, that straight afterwards we went off into Eastern Europe with the Bathmans and the smuggling Bibles into Eastern Europe, and what a wonderful privilege it was to go with my parents-in-law and my new wife into Eastern Europe, learning so many scores and hundreds of anecdotes and answers to prayer and insights from Bill Bathman, who had been there for 50-odd years going into Eastern Europe, and to go into these churches, just absolutely magnificent. Our first attempt was to go and check Slovakia, and we were there 5 hours, and then they kicked us out. They wouldn't let us come in because they knew Bill Bathman too well. And then we went to Yugoslavia and Hungary and Romania, and what magnificent ministry opportunities we had. But shortly after that, we saw the Berlin Wall coming down, and collapsing of the communist regimes throughout the whole of Eastern Europe. They'd spent decades building up their wall and shooting their own citizens in the back. But the resistance of the people throughout Eastern Europe was magnificent. I saw some of the strongest Christians imaginable praying, protesting, resilient, and undermining the Marxists. I heard some of the greatest humor in the behind the Iron Curtain. On that trip 20 years ago, I remember people saying, in a communist country, it's good not to think. Don't think. But if you think, don't speak. And if you are so foolhardy as to speak, whatever you don't write. And if you are so reckless as to write, don't sign. And if you sign, don't be surprised. And then another man was saying, there are five contradictions in any communist country. The first contradiction is, nobody works. But the five-year plan is always accomplished. The five-year plan is always accomplished. But the marketplace always empty. The market is empty, but the people always have enough to eat. The people always have enough to eat, but nobody is satisfied. Nobody is satisfied, but we all applaud. But those are the five contradictions of a communist country. In the insights of these people, they were talking about one man who lost his parrot. He was in Moscow, and his parrot went missing. He was desperately tearing around the whole city trying to find his parrot. And in the end, he came to the KGB headquarters in downtown Moscow and he said, a comrade, I want to report my parrot is missing. They said, go away, we don't care about your parrot. He said, well, I know that comrade, but if you find him, I want you to know that I disagree with all his opinions. And then there's another one that I learned in Yugoslavia. They said there was this man who was very disturbed, so he went to the psychologist. He was amazed when he got in there. There was 40 or 50 people ahead of him sitting in the waiting room. And he took a number and he waited and spent the whole day moving from one seat to another. By the end of the day, he gets into the psychologist and the psychologist says, what's the problem? The man says, you know, I'm sorry, I've forgotten. I've been sitting out this long. Psychologist says, don't worry, sit down. Let me jog your memory. Is it a work problem? No, he said, there's no problem at work. He said, there's either no raw materials or there's no electricity, so there's no work at work. He said, is it a financial problem? He says, oh, goodness me. Nothing in the shops to buy anywhere. They said, is it a housing problem? No, he says, we've got 20 square feet and there's just my wife and six children and mother-in-law with me and we've got more space than most people. So he said, is it a domestic problem? That's it, he says. It's my wife and I, we cannot agree. My wife says communism is scientific. I say it's political. Now, which of us is right? So the psychologist looks around, he checks it all, he turns up the music on the radio and he turns the tap on, he leans over and he says, you're right. It's political. If it was scientific, they would have experimented on animals first. So this is what the people are saying over there. Then there was another one, three men in a boxcar on the railways heading off to Siberia concentration camp. So they pass the time, ask, well, how did you get here? And the man says, well, I was 5 minutes late for work and they accused me of economic sabotage. I asked the other man, and you? He says, well, I was 5 minutes early for work and they accused me of industrial espionage. So I asked the other man, what are you here for? He says, well, I was on time. And I said, on time? Said, yes, they checked and saw my watch was made in West Germany. The only way you could be on time is if you had a watch made in the West. These are the kind of jokes they had in East Europe. And that's how they stayed sane. They spoke about, when I got there, they were talking about different attempts on the life of Pastor Paul and the groups and the church officials and all that had been going on. So I asked if they had done any official complaints about them. And their answer is always to give some kind of parable. And they said, well, there were these sheep and they were attacked by these wolves and the wolves ripped them to pieces and it was a terrible mess the next day. And sheep were horrified and they sent a delegation to the lion, the king of the beast, to complain about this atrocity by the wolves. So the lion was very sympathetic and he said that you may be sure that something will be done about this day. And sure enough, later that day, a delegation of investigators arrived to investigate the complaint. But he said the investigators were all wolves. And so that's what happened in Eastern Europe. The people never gave in to communism. They hated it, and the time came when the Berlin Wall came down and the Iron Curtain collapsed, and there were celebrations like you would never believe. In all my life, I've never seen anything like the celebrations for the coming down of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Iron Curtain, and the euphoria in Eastern Europe. And we were able to go before and after to East Germany, to Poland, to Romania, to Hungary, to Bulgaria, to Albania. It was just absolutely extraordinary to see the collapse of this. And I remember as a young Christian hearing people asking. In fact, I remember 1981, Brother Andrew saying, when I was at Hospital Christian Fellowship, actually it was 82, he said, we are starting a 7-year Jericho prayer focus on the Iron Curtain, that God will bring down the Iron Curtain in 7 years, and we are calling people back. I remember sitting there in 1982 at Hospital Christian Fellowship thinking, the Berlin Wall is not going to come down in our lifetime. It's not going to come down until Jesus comes again. I mean, what's the chance of the Iron Curtain ever coming down? I didn't believe it. And I must say, I didn't have the faith. And I bowed my head when they prayed, but I don't think I was praying in my heart in belief. I hated the Berlin Wall. I'd been there. I'd seen it as a young boy at age 12, but I did not believe that this could come down in our lifetime. And yet it did. Well, the other great interesting development in the latter half of the 20th century has been the development of desktop publishing and the internet. So the internet is an amazing opportunity. Now, in the 1990s, there was also a dramatic increase in persecution of Christians in Muslim nations like Sudan, Nigeria, Pakistan, Indonesia, and yet revival and persecution in some places. The persecution has been horrific in some of these countries. Sudan, of course, we've emphasized a lot in our mission, as that was my personal main emphasis in the last half of the 90s and early part of this new century. But the amount of jihad, scorched earth, mutilations, chopping off of arms, chopping off the feet of evangelists, and yet the Christians rose up and fought back and gave the Muslims a serious series of defeats. And so praise God that Christians have had the opportunity of strengthening those who are under persecution in these Muslim countries, and it's a major battlefield. They were trying to see the Nile as a highway into Africa, but they've met a barrier in South Sudan and the Nuba, which has prevented the south of expansion of Islam. Praise God for that. It was the missionaries in the 19th century, such as C.T. Studd, who saw the need to put mission bases high up in Africa as possible to stop the south of expansion of Islam. And it worked for a century. But now we need a new series of missionary endeavors in those areas to plug the gap and to give the Christians in those areas backbone to resist Islam. And that's what's happening. Southern Sudan, the Christian church is so strong, and the resilience and the resistance to Islam is so intense that I don't think Islam has any chance in the next several generations of getting through those people. Unfortunately, while we've seen the Christians in North Africa fighting Islam, we see the Christians in Southern Africa kowtowing to and bowing to new idols in Marxism and worshipping of atheists and humanists in our own country. The African National Congress has come to prominence and international support through things like the Church Street car bombing, necklacing people, murdering people, car bombs, limpet mines, landmines, church attacks like by the PAC upload terrorists at St. James, murdering of people, and yet, interestingly enough, to this day, there's more sympathy for this one Marxist who was in charge of Umkhonto we Sizwe at the time, and the chairman of the Southern Communist Party at the time, Chris Hani. He was shot by a Pole, someone from Poland, who said, I've lived all my life under communism, I don't want to see it coming in here. And so someone assassinated the chief assassin, and yet there was such an outpouring of grief, anger, and concern. To this day, the people responsible are still in jail, while the ones responsible for the St. James massacre were released. It's a bit bizarre. Damn it. Thank you.
judges that there were three judges who said they could only have one, and they must be
I mean, since when does a member of the family of somebody speak judgment over...
Did they ask the people in St. James Church who had lost loved ones if they wanted the Upla terrorists who murdered their people to be released? This is very strange. But you can see also something fascinating is straight after the handover to Nelson Mandela and the ANC, Harry Oppenheimer authored an article which got major prominence, op-ed in the Sunday Times, where he boasted that it was De Beers, an Anglo-American corporation who worked for years to bring the ANC to power. And this is the fulfillment of decades and generations of their work. And, well, a lot of people had said that, but the people who had said that in the past would have been called conspiracy theorists. It was quite fascinating to see that Harry Oppenheimer confirmed that the conspiracy theorists were actually on target, and they were behind it. And we knew that Anglo-American was funding a lot of these activities and undermining the country from within. This is something that's very interesting, that all the way through, how many different conflicts, there are books that have been written, like by Sutton, on Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. All the rise of these various dictators have somehow had capitalists behind. And I didn't understand it, but then somebody explained that Anglo-American in Zambia, talking about Kenneth Kaunda's socialist Zambia, hadn't raised the salaries of the workers ever, not since independence. And in Zambia, if there was a demonstration, which wasn't often, against Anglo-American or the mine something, the police or army just came out and shot the people. Simple. That's the end of the demo. No more, not rubber bullets, we're talking about hard rounds. And Anglo-American just had to pay off the government, and they didn't have to worry about laws and labor, and, you know, that didn't matter. All you had to do is look after the commie at top. So in a one-party dictatorship, it's easier for some of these multinationals to do what they want. I don't know if that's their motivation. It's hard to believe people could just be motivated by raw greed. But there's something more than that. It seems somehow that they want a one-world order. And it's this talk of a global conspiracy, an Illuminati, the Council on Foreign Relations certainly is a very real thing, and they seem to have their fingers in so much. So while there's a lot of books out there about the New World Order and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Illuminati and the Council on Foreign Relations, and somehow there's conspiracies, we may not know all the truth of everything, because conspiracies by their very nature are pretty secret. And you get a little bit here and a hint there and a glimmer there. But here in South Africa, we had the number one richest man in the whole of Africa, at least before Mugabe kleptomaniac stole how many hundreds of billions from his country. But here we have the richest man in a legal sense, legitimate sense, admitting that he was, for his most of his life, dedicating the full resource of the biggest multinational company in this continent to bringing an illegal Marxist terrorist revolutionary group to power, and boasting at the end, we did it. I thought that was quite fascinating. What can we say about dear Bishop Desmond Tutu? I must say, although he has surprised us with some of his honesty in at least being able to admit, unlike many of the people he supports, that Mugabe, who initially he had said was God's anointed deliverer, and that the kingdom of God arrived in Zimbabwe, he has since then admitted that Mugabe must go, and he's even suggested South Africa use troops to remove him. And if the African Union sends troops to remove him, the United Nations should send troops to remove him. So that's interesting. He's also expressed this great horror over a lot of what's happened in this country. Well, he did more than any other single individual after Oppenheimer to bring about this present situation. So the fact that he's not publicly happy with it is interesting. But all the same, we do remember that Bishop Tutu is the one who said things like, if the Russians invaded South Africa, we would welcome them as saviors. He said, my leader is Nelson Mandela. And he said that when the man was in jail, a terrorist. He said that Jesus was born of a common woman, illegitimately, to identify with common people. Of course there's mistakes in the Bible. Man wrote it, not God. He said the Holy Spirit's not limited to the Christian church. Why? Mahatma Gandhi, the Holy Spirit shines through him. And so he's obviously an a New Age, interfaith, liberation theology, Marxist, humanist, very pro-homosexual, very pro-abortion, has never come out against abortion in this country and so on. And so, what are we to think about Desmond Tutu? Is he a hardcore Marxist, or is he a useful idiot, to use Lenin's term? I mean, what would we think? Is he a media creation? Does he know what he's doing? Is he just a pawn in someone's hands? I mean, I'm not totally sure where this man stands, because he does make some right noises every now and then. He's every now and then, he's spoken out against Mugabe, which is unusual. Most of the ANC supporters don't. But still, you know, is he somebody who's just playing for the crowd? He certainly was the most effective tool in the Marxist hands in the run-up to the 1994 elections. He more than anyone else legitimized the ANC worldwide. What few people realize is in 1994, the very month, the very week that South Africa was having the elections here, the Holocaust in Rwanda erupted, killing 800,000 Christians in just 6 weeks. The Interahamwe mass murderers, and if you haven't seen the films like Hotel Rwanda or Shooting Dogs, Beyond the Gates is the American title for Shooting Dogs, you probably should if you can handle a tough film. Because the Holocaust in Rwanda was absolutely incredible. At the roadblocks, just heaping up the dead, murdering people, just because they're the wrong tribe. Churches packed full of people being massacred. More people killed in churches and hospitals than anywhere else. We've documented this in Holocaust Rwanda, but the timing was deliberate. They timed it to coincide with the Mandela election and inauguration, knowing that world attention wouldn't care what's going on anywhere else in Africa. Mm. And all the journalists are going to be concentrated in South Africa, so they've got a free hand for a few weeks, which they used. And so the manipulation of the media and the use of liberal church leaders, the heads of the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church were totally involved in organizing, not just cooperating, but organizing the massacres of the Tutsi Christians. And to this day, many of them are living under the protection of France. And France signed the Anti-Genocide Treaty, which is a meaningless piece of paper, considering the fact that whenever a real genocide takes place, they're supporting the architects of the genocide, and they give them every kind of protection, indemnity from prosecution. And they sent in the Foreign Legion to help them escape as well. Well, in South Africa, we did have one man who upset a lot of the apple cart when the ANC was trying to have their ascent to power, and that was Dr. Buthelezi, who had always been an opponent of apartheid, very courageously so, even when it was exceedingly unpopular. But he was against sanctions. He said sanctions are going to impoverish our people. In fact, he just recently, when we met him in Zululand, pointed out that the very same people who today are saying you can't put sanctions on Zimbabwe, it's going to hurt the economy and hurt the people, he said they're using the same arguments I used against sanctions on South Africa. They wanted sanctions on South Africa, even though it put millions of black people out of work, impoverished this country, lost us jobs, chased away investment. Many of the people today who are impoverished and out of work is because of the ANC policy of sanctions. They blame it on apartheid, but actually it was the sanctions of Tutu that brought about this impoverishment. And he's now seeing that the very people who oppose his arguments are using the same arguments he used just to stop sanctions being imposed in Zimbabwe. And there are no sanctions imposed in Zimbabwe. You realize there's sanctions imposed on the government of Zimbabwe, not on the people. The foreigners are pouring in aid. But when Rhodesia had total sanctions, nobody starved. No one starved in Rhodesia. We had famine, we had war, we had the Soviet Union against us, we had Red China against us, we had the Commonwealth against us, we had the Organization of African Union against us, we had the United Nations against us, we had total economic worldwide sanctions on Rhodesia, and nobody starved, and the Rhodesian dollar was 3 times stronger than the American dollar, and unemployment was virtually nil, and the country had the lowest crime rate in the world. And now, with foreign aid, and no war, and no sanctions, except on just a few top leaders, which doesn't affect the people on the ground, the country has broken all world records for the highest inflation in the world and the worst everything and the lowest life expectancy. Just mindless that folks can't see that. This is the massacre of Zulu supporters of Nkata at Shell House, outside Shell House, where Nelson Mandela admitted he ordered the ANC security people to open fire on these demonstrators, who, as you can see, all they had was some sticks and shields. There's no guns visible. But in any other country in the world, a leader who had ordered a massacre like that would be at least out of politics for life. Interesting, in this country, it didn't cause a blip on the computer screen. The biggest demonstration ever in Cape Town still remains our Christian Voice marches 1995 and 1996. It was Adderley Street. Now, let me just remind you that according to the Argus, there were 3,000 marching. According to the Cape Times, there were 300 marching. According to police, there were 30,000 marching. Just interesting, just in case you thought that mathematics was an exact science, what's a few zeros between? There were people still at the castle when the rest of us had arrived at Parliament. That's how long the procession was. This jam-packed. This was to protest against the secular state and against all the things with our memorandums against abortion, pornography, homosexuality, the whole deal. Constitution must be upon God's law. And they just kept coming and coming and coming. And this was an example of the opposition of people in Cape Town to this government. And they were shaking in their boots. And we've heard from some of our friends who were in Parliament at that time that, in fact, they really were terrified. And that's why they pushed Cyril Ramaphosa out the door. And Cyril Ramaphosa didn't want to go, but he is like the most junior person that he'd get out there to speak to these crazy Christians. And Kenneth Mesher says the ANC leaders were terrified. They thought this is the end. They couldn't believe so many people could march and wouldn't rip them to pieces, you know, what they would have done, basically. But there wasn't so much as litter left behind. We didn't break one window. There was no damage to any property. And when this Cyril Ramaphosa came out, I wish I could got a picture of it. But he is standing there, and he sees Finis Obisi of Christians for Truth with a leather Bible that was given to him by the Bathmans in Phoenix, and it's got embroidered on it, on the leather cover, Reverend Finis Obisi. I mean, you could see it. And Cyril Ramaphosa says, "Brother, can I borrow your Bible?" And he takes it and he gets up to him. He says, "I'm also a Christian. I bring my Bible to Parliament every day." And we're all standing around there looking at one, and Fano and I are just like, politicians lie. How can you, but so blatantly and brazenly. I mean, literally, I was close enough to be, while he was waving, I could see Fano Sabisa's name on the Bible. I wish I'd got a picture right there of that. That he could lie like that, so openly. Politicians lie. You can always tell when a politician lies, his lips move. And even when he dies, he lies still. Well, our marches were under the slogan of Back to the Bible and Front Fetal Quotes of It. And by God's grace, we made a good stand. You can see, interestingly enough, you see General Constantine over here. And there's a lot of interesting people that were in the march at different times. This was our first National Day of Repentance up on the garden in front of Union Buildings in Pretoria. And particularly repenting for the national sins of abortion and pornography. And Dr. Ed Cain, now we're there at this particular prayer meeting, and this was one of the more effective ones. Trouble is, with every passing year, it looks like there's more apathy on the part of people to the national sins. Initially, it created a shock. But in time, people who were very against these things in 95, 96, sort of have come to, oh well, and this is why tyrants stay in power when good people do nothing. And that's why we've got to, our biggest problem isn't the pagans, our biggest problem is the Christians, to wake the Christians up. If we can mobilize them up, things would be different. Well, the new millennium began with the Islamic terror attack on the World Trade Center and the start of America's war against terror. Of course, it had started a bit before that. Remember, 1998, there was the terrorist attack on the United States Embassy in Nairobi. 5,000 people injured, over 240 people killed. That didn't seem to be enough to wake people up. But the attack on the World Trade Center, I think that should have woken people up. Here you can see the debris of the World Trade Center coming down on a church, a mission church, close by, within literally shadow of the World Trade Center. And so, troops marched off to war. Since September the 11th, 2001, more critical books on Islam have been written than in the previous centuries. And they keep coming out. There's more, I can't even keep track of them. It's amazing how many books are coming out I just heard today, for example, from Anna Marie in the States that she sold 100 slavery terrorism Islams in separate transactions in one day after she had let it be known on the internet the availability of it. She said that the Amazon.com had actually gone up to $460 a copy for a second-hand copy of our Slavery, Terrorism, Islam book on the internet. So there's obviously a demand. And we are seeing the first cracks in a monolithic empire of Islam. For example, the Taliban, probably the most radical Islamic regime in the world in Afghanistan, was toppled by American forces. And Islam is a big problem. They are radical. Of course, when some Danish newspaper cartoonist did a few funny cartoons about Islam, all of which were pretty on target, nothing near as bad as the things against Christianity given in the recent UCT mag, by the way. Islam, to prove that they're not violent and tolerant, went out and burned and destroyed as much as it could Danish embassies, Norwegian embassies, Austrian embassies. Had nothing to do with them, but doesn't matter, they're all white, Western, something, you know, European. And the Paris riots destroyed thousands of cars, hundreds of buildings and blocks, just massive, massive destruction. The London bombings, of course, by these four suicide bombers. And just look at these London demonstrations. This is by peaceful, tolerant Muslims. Aren't you glad they're not violent and intolerant? Imagine if they're violent and intolerant. Behead those who insult Islam. Imagine if Christians marched against UCT, behead those who insult Christianity. Could you imagine? Something like, would anyone think that was intolerant or unacceptable? Slay those who insult Islam. Europe, you will pay. Demolition is on its way. Which of those who mock Islam? Europe, you will pay. Extermination is on its way. Exterminate those who slander Islam. Europe is the cancer. Islam is the answer. And here you can see them burning the Christian flag on the Danish flag, the Christian cross on the Danish flag. Now, if we were to burn some Quranic script on the Saudi Arabian flag, do you think they might object? Freedom go to hell. I think that's very eloquent. Europe takes some lessons from 9/11. But I wish they would. But I think this man's got something else in mind. Europe, you'll pay. Your 9/11 is on its way. Be prepared for the real Holocaust. I mean, we haven't seen anything yet, apparently. Massacre those who insult Islam. And by the way, do you notice the British police guarding these thugs wearing their terrorist masks? Can you imagine that British bobbies now think it's their duty to stand by and protect thugs like this? I saw something even more horrific recently that, and I must integrate this picture soon, but there were British troops coming back from Afghanistan to their hometown where they would normally be welcomed as soldiers coming back from having done their unpleasant duty. And there's a group of violent, vicious Muslims with their faces contorted with hatred, spewing hatred and all kinds of death threats on them and so on, posters. British police standing by doing nothing. The only people arrested were some local supporters and relatives of the soldiers who shouted something at these protests, and they got arrested for hate speech. It sounds insane. Insane. It's as though the people in Europe are temporarily insane, like they've lost their minds. They are so tolerant and so protective of these mass murdering thugs and these death threatening jihadists and people who are such traitors. To think how they used to treat people in those countries that they considered traitors. Do you know, in the Second World War, people who opposed the war just didn't support being involved in the war. Forget about supporting the enemy. They didn't support the enemy. They just didn't think Britain should be involved in the war. They locked them up. Do you know, in South Africa, we had people locked up here for opposing the war in the First and Second World War. These people can oppose your army, spit in their face to go past, threaten them with death, and they protected, and someone who's a patriotic citizen is locked up for hate speech. And you can just see the peace and tolerance just oozing out of these people's faces. And the Quran is a book of tolerance and peace, and you can just see how the Quran is inspiring such peace and tolerance. We need to pray for the persecuted Christians suffering under Islam. And we need to pray for the women suffering under Islam in particular. And we must pray that the church may respond to the threat of Islam with prayer and action to win Muslims for Christ. This is the greatest battle of the 21st century, to fight Islam. The greatest challenge for us is to go and make disciples of all nations, and the Middle East is the toughest nut to crack. It's the biggest stronghold in the 1040 window of the unreached resistant nations. Praying for the Muslim world and evangelizing Muslim nations is absolutely critical. This is the biggest battlefield. If only our predecessors and ancestors in Europe could have understood this in 1914 and not wasted all their time and energy and weaponry on fighting one another, and just recognized the biggest threat to come is Islam, and of course Marxism later. But if they hadn't fought one another in 1914, it wouldn't even be a Marxist threat. Marxism came in after Christians had been fighting one another. Now, we've got a whole lot of articles on Islam, of course, on our website, and I'm wanting to show you a whole lot of resources that we can use in the fight. But some of the greatest names in the 20th century: Karl Barth, of course, very important Swiss journalist, Swiss theologian, although unfortunately he did compromise some points despite his good intentions in neo-orthodoxy, neo-evangelicalism. C.S. Lewis, this Oxford and Cambridge don, who became a vibrant Christian apologist. Some call him the finest apologist of the 20th century, certainly in Britain. Billy Graham, for better or worse, the most public representative of Christianity in the 20th century. Unfortunately, he has reduced the gospel down to a core that previous generations would have considered too small. And therefore, while he preaches his core of the gospel quite well, it's not enough. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, one of the greatest minds Russia has produced, brilliant author, brilliant poet, a Nobel Literature Award winner, a man who spent years in Russian concentration camps. And do you know, he fought in Russia's armies in the Second World War, and he was imprisoned as a slave in the Gulag for over 10 years for criticizing some aspects of communism in this country. You would have thought he was a war hero from Russian perspective. But just criticizing the government, the sort of thing we do all the time, got him locked up in a slave camp. Richard von Brandt, the Romanian Christian who suffered horrendous persecution and torture under the communists in Romania. Francis Schaeffer, the brilliant apologist from America. What a joy it has been to go through his whole series of How Should We Then Live? And if you haven't seen that documentary series or read any of his books, well worth getting into. Dr. R.J. Rushdoony, we've got many of his books here, like Institutes of Biblical Law. Brilliant leader of the Reconstructionist movement. And Dr. R.J. Rushdoony comes from the Arminian people. Now, we're not talking about the Arminian theology, we're talking about the Arminians, not talking about the Arminian theology, but the Arminian people who live in the Caucasus, roughly where the Ark of Noah ended, close to Turkey. And he has, in his family, always had male relatives involved in the ministry going back for something like 14 centuries. And his grandparents were murdered coming out in the Turkish massacres of 1915, and I think just his parents came out. And so there's all kinds of stories in his own life on that. Dr. James Kennedy, certainly one of the most effective Christian apologists in the media and Christian evangelists. Now, we have produced over the last few years several history resources, like An Overview of Church History, King Alfred the Great and Oliver Cromwell, George Whitfield and Jonathan Edwards, Reformation Switzerland. To make things easy, we've got a 6-disc box set for understanding history, and now a 12-disc box set to understand some of the key events in history, which all have the PowerPoints with them. The Anglo-Zulu War, the Anglo-Boer War, First and Second, the Battle for South Africa, which I've just touched on a bit today, but of course we dealt with it in much greater depth. To help as well, we've made up this disc of South African history, just the first 6 discs on South African history that we've produced, which includes the PowerPoints. And of course our books, The Greatest Sense of Missions, and I would highly recommend Sketches from Church History as the best banner of truth book it gives a good overview of two millenniums of Christianity in a most readable fashion with lots and lots of illustrations. Our contribution to it has also been slavery, terrorism, Islam, understand the historical roots and contemporary threats of Islam, and then the greatest century of Reformation. So those are three main history books we've produced. To understand recent 20th century history, remembering Rhodesia, some of the DVDs that can really assist in us understanding history would be Amazing Grace on William Wilberforce and a campaign against slavery, Hotel Rwanda, understand Rwandese Holocaust. Some of our new audio CD sets include Serving the Persecuted, where we have a whole 10 disc box set on some of our main areas of ministering, such as in Sudan, in Angola, Zimbabwe. Evangelizing in the War Zones, we've put together six of our best examples of ministering in the war zones. And in other historical figures, character studies, we've gone into like George Frederick Handel, Johann Sebastian Bach, Blaise Pascal, Heroines of the Faith, Florence Nightingale and Anne Askew, Perpetua, the Christian martyr for Christ, and John Huss. Battlefields for Reformation tries to look at contemporary, what are the battlefields we've got to fight now today. The eschatology of victory is to me important because history's got a purpose, and we are not just focused on the past. We're interested in the past because we want to make a better future. And also, Christian history is going it's going without any doubt towards the culmination of history, which is the fulfillment of the Great Commission, the discipleship of the nations, the return of Christ, eternal judgment, victory and vindication of Christ. And so I think it's important when we study history to also understand eschatology end time. Virtually everything we've ever dealt with at the Reformation Society should be on the reformationsa.org website. So on this website, just about everything we've dealt with should be available at least in written form. Any questions at all? I'm still working on my history of Africa in total. So I don't feel that I've reached all the conclusions or gathered all material. But what I've looked at so far, I would see decolonization as mostly negative, because it's led to the deaths of millions and millions of Christians. Nigeria, Congo, I mean, just thinking of the Biafran War, the Congolese Wars, the Simba Rebellion, the United Nations intervention, what's happened in Somalia, Rwanda, Sudan, it's horrific. So to me, handing over Africa to Marxist dictators or Muslim dictators, which has been most of it, has been generally a catastrophe. So the human death toll has been huge. Africa's also had its economic progress arrested, whereas Africa was going in the first half of the 20th century up. Roads, railways, bridges, schools, hospitals, literacy, everything was just improving. Nobody started. In fact, by 1960, things like cholera was basically extinct, malaria was basically wiped out. And then the reverse, the health crisis in Africa has just got worse and worse and worse, and the standards of living plummeting. Now, some people have benefited, there's no doubt, especially political elites. But for the basic person, while I'm sure everyone's happy to have better medical, but nobody's got better medical now than they had before, really, when you get down to it. In most of Africa, things have deteriorated. And this is proven by the fact that 40% of Africa's wealth is held offshore. 40% of Africa's wealth is held offshore. This documented in the Shackled Continent by the British Tom Guest, the BBC man, the British economist, that Africa has failed to convince its own citizens that Africa is worth investing in. Most Africans keep their wealth elsewhere. And every year we lose, there's 26,000 tertiary graduates, that's 26,000 people who have university degrees, leave the country, doctors, professionals, engineers, and so on. Leave the country. 26,000 a year. We can't replace it. That's not counting the ones who went overseas to study to return but didn't return. Not counting them. So, Africa had such great potential. I just think of how optimistic everyone was in Rhodesia, for example, when they were building the Kariba Dam and electric, hydroelectric power for everybody, and there's just all this optimism of the 60s and 70s was shattered. So And people like Mugabe, of course, is the worst example of what's been symptomatic in quite a few other places. But there are good examples of exceptions. You know, Botswana's a stable country, but they're homogeneous. They've got one tribe and they've not that many people. Botswana's an exception. Namibia seems to be doing surprisingly well again with the sponsorship of Western, which put a lot of effort into it, and it's not done very badly at all. It's quite a few false starts, but Namibia is one of the more stable, but aside from Botswana and Namibia, most of the examples are up there are pretty negative, and country being amongst it. Generally speaking, I think decolonization will be looked back at by future generations in all the hype and emotion of the 20th century gone. I think that people look back at, like we looked at the fall of the Roman Empire and the Dark Ages coming into Europe at first, as disaster, catastrophe. And it doesn't matter how much they shout about how wonderful it is. Having travelled around Africa, I'm not impressed. I think that decolonization has been a horrible false start, and I believe Africa can do better, and Africa deserves better, and what's going on at the moment is totally unacceptable. I don't think any of us should be satisfied. This is not the way Africa should be run, and we can do a lot better than this. So I'm determined to push for the 21st century being the century of reformation. It's just shameful to think that we've been stolen from so much, that the people think their job is to still vote for these people, to steal from them and destroy them. As witnessed in Zimbabwe and South Africa to a large extent. But if I go to a university and I'm speaking on the crisis in this country, I will have people in this country generally angry and shouting at me, and I'll have the Zimbabweans and Congolese and others agreeing with me, which just goes to show there's the ones who know what you're talking about, and then there's the ones who seem to think paradise is still ahead. But the people who have already had paradise, like in America, it's been pointed out by political analysts, they said Hispanics who come from Cuba are Republican and a conservative. Hispanics who come from Mexico are Democrats. What's the difference? In Mexico, they're still expecting socialist workers' paradise. In Cuba, they've already had it. So the Cubans are anti-communist, anti-socialist, because they've experienced it. The Mexicans are pro-communist, pro-socialist, because they still think it's coming. That's the difference between a Zimbabwean and a South African. A Zimbabwean knows what communism is. A South African thinks communism is going to be wonderful when it gets here. So, but I realize that's an inadequate response, because Africa's so big and we've got 55 countries. But just taking, for example, Sudan, they just wish the British had listened to the missionaries who all pleaded to them, don't give southern Sudan independence in the same country as northern Sudan. Make it part of Uganda, make it part of Kenya, make it a separate country, anything, but don't give it to the Arabs. For some obscure, dumb reason, they put this tropical, black, Christian, English-speaking south under Muslim, Arab, north from the desert. There's no reason for it to be one country. It's not one country. It's geographically, linguistically, in every way. They work on different calendars. They've got different alphabets. And yet, to make the poor southerners live under the northerners is just wicked. And how many millions of people died as a result of that stupid decision of, oh, well, just... You know that just about every map in Africa is the same as it was in the Kenya, with exception of Eritrea. Every border in Africa is as it was at independence. In other words, they let the Europeans draw the map, and it's heresy to suggest that you should redraw the map according to ethno-linguistic or religious lines, such as the South Sudanese are trying to do. They want to redraw the map and let Southern Sudan go independent, which is what they've been fighting for 50 years. Only Eritrea was able to redraw the map, but that, of course, is a bit different because the Italians held Eritrea. Ethiopia was Abyssinia, which was independent always. And the Italians took Abyssinia, the South Africans freed Abyssinia. That's how we got 93,000 Italian prisoners suddenly turning up in Transvaal to help build our roads. During the war, they were capturing Abyssinia by the South African forces. But when South Africa liberated Ethiopia, Abyssinia, the the United Nations later after the war decided to amalgamate Italian Eritrea with Ethiopia, with Somalia, make it Ethiopian country. That put a lot of Muslims in Eritrea under the Christians in Abyssinia, which led to such problems, such wars. Of course, the communists took over later, murdered the royal family of Abyssinia. So, Haile Selassie came. So this is the only example we can think of a map being redrawn, that Eritrea managed to win its independence. But they were a separate country before the 40s. So it's not really a good example. But if South Sudan manages to win its independence, that will be a major breakthrough. Because that's what they were finding for in Biafra. They wanted the Christian south of Nigeria to be separate from the Muslim north. And the Soviet Union, Red China, Great Britain and America were all fighting on the side or supporting the Muslim north to crush the Christian south. Only Portugal and South Africa were helping the Biafran Christians. A scandal. Good. Any other comments, questions? Western Sahara was actually a Spanish colony. And it stayed a Spanish colony till 1975, was it? When they then handed over to Morocco and Mauritania to share. And Algeria never accepted that, and so there's a long-standing war. And I think one of the longest walls in Africa has been built to try and keep out the Algerian terrorists coming into Western Sahara, which is apparently very rich in minerals. But that was a Spanish colony that was handed over to Morocco and Mauritania. Algerians aren't happy. I mean, typical. But just about every war in the world today, 95% of them, I'm told, have Islam as the common denominator. Considering they're 1/6 of the world's population, it's amazing they're the common denominator of 95% of the world. Imagine if there were violence. It's a good thing they're peaceful, I mean, too. It's just... So, I think that's the history of the 21st century still to be written, is what is the West going to do in terms of the fight against Islam? Islam will either destroy freedom in the West, or the West will have to defeat Islam. There's no alternative. You will not coexist with Islam. Islam will destroy your freedom, or you will have to fight them. And it's not that we've declared war on Islam, it's that they've declared war on us. Beheading Christians in Indonesia, stoning Christians in Pakistan, crucifying Christians in Sudan. Honestly, what more needs to be said? To the people in Sudan that I speak to, the people in Nigeria I speak to them, the biggest issue is Islam.